Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Questlove Supreme. This is our part two interview with the one and only CeeLo Green. Part one, we talked about the beginnings of his life, growing up in Atlanta, forming the Dungeon Family, and of course, making classic music with Goody Mob. And pretty much for part two, we go to the second phase of his life. There's Gnarls Barkley, there's his solo work, and you know, there's pretty much life in the last 10 years, changes that he's made, decisions that he's made, and how it's affected his life. And it's very revelatory. I think you guys should listen. You'll enjoy part two of our interview with the one and only CeeLo Green, Questlove Supreme. Let's go. Hey, that rhymes. How does one, well, it's actually a two-parter because, you know, you said you really weren't with the direction of the record. Who is the alpha, who's the alpha goody that one is the anchor that brings everyone together to have a meeting or discussion about it? Or my second question is, how do you dissolve the situation? What was the process of you leaving the group to start your Perfect Imperfections and the Soul Machine projects?
Well, we had just done not too long ago, maybe like, you know, I think in March, you know, our episode of Unsung had aired, and we kind of touched on that. Yeah. And, you know, it was me and Timo that discussed very plainly that, you know, after that project, everybody wanted to venture out and do solo projects. You know, everybody's always had an ambition to do it, but like we kind of stumbled upon our own synergy and became kind of, you know, safeguarded by that. You know what I mean? Like, you know, because we did ultimately have three consecutive gold records, but we were only kind of like slated to do just one record. I mean, being that it was just meant to be a compilation. And then also we were friends and you know, like, and we were kind of, you know, if you will, we ganged in. I'm saying, like, you know what I mean? Like, we loyal, like, down with each other. So it's like, you know, everybody felt a certain kind of way by feeling anything ulterior to, you know what I mean? Like, you know, goody, you know what I mean? Like, you know, but, you know, I had to be true to thine self, you know what I mean? Like, you know, because the fact of the matter is I was always poised to be a solo artist anyway. And at that point, I really was ready. You know what I'm saying? Like, I can honestly say, at the beginning, I wasn't, but that after three albums and after touring consecutively and accomplishing what we accomplished, I said, okay, I think we made our impression. It's like this. So I knew somewhat, I mean, of what I could accomplish if I applied myself outside of Goody Mob. You know what I mean? Like,
do you think the Santana record kind of helped you get it did. To that point?
It did. I gotta give thanks and praise to Ms. Lauren Hill. You know what I mean? Like, who reached out to me. We all befriended each other on those first tours. Roots, you know, Goody Mob and the Fugees. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, it's crazy. So with that, she came and got me, you know, and I didn't even really, I knew that I could sing, but I wasn't really tripping, you know, but, you know, it was her, Joy, and Erykah Badu are the first. You know, that's like the Holy Trinity right there. And I'm saying, you feel me? Like, I worked with them separately. I remember going to New York with Erykah once, and she wanted me to come out on stage and just sing something. And I said, okay, well, what you want me to do? She said, just do whatever you want to do. And I just hummed and moaned and wailed and, you know. and then I sung background vocals for Joy, too.
So CeeLo, have you done any, so in your evolution as a singer, have you done any maintenance on your voice, any kind of coach, like, because it seems like as you evolved, got into that Gnarls bag and stuff, and you started experimenting with different things in your voice that, you know, it was challenging.
Starting to come out?
Yeah.
Well, damn, Chris, what was your question again? I just want to make sure I get it. I mean,
how'd you quit the group?
Oh, okay. Why Unsung? So you put your stamp on Unsung.
Yeah, but I don't have cable on the farm.
But look, okay. So look, it was agreed upon. We all had an understanding. Now, how it digressed into you know what I mean? Like a lot of the internal riffings and, you know, they kind of, you know, spilled over into the street. I really don't know. I mean, like, I really wasn't emotionally vested in that way. I mean, like, because it was my understanding that there was an understanding. I mean, like, you know, I was defaulted. I mean, like, you know, like out of the group, because I had always felt like, yo, like, we'll go try these other things and then we'll come back, you know, as we ultimately end up, you know, doing. But
that's how I think it should be.
Yeah, me too.
Take some time off, do what you gotta do, come back
and come back to it. I mean, so with that, you know, I mean, I just knew that it was time for me to make a move. And it's funny that me and Gip talking about this recently. He said, man, well, Lo, you know, you were right. I mean, like, it's not something that we could have foresaw. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and Gip answered it the best on the episode of Unsung. He said, I knew that, you know, that time would ultimately come at some point. He said, but no matter when that time came, it most likely wasn't going to ever be the right time for me. You know what I'm saying? And I didn't know that they cared that much. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, because I also looked at music as recreation. So when I came out with Closet Freak and did that album, that's just me, you know, having fun, just kind of like peacocking and showing people, hey, man, like, yeah, I got other stuff in me. I, you know what I'm saying? I could do all other kind of shit. You know what I mean?
My favorite song on that album, like, it wasn't even like a full song, but I love it to death. Basshead Jazz.
Yeah,
I love that fucking song, man. That was the one for me. I played that shit on repeat for hours.
You want to know something dope about Basshead Jazz? And a lot of people say that, man. Like, the reason why the beat keeps cutting off because it got erased, and I just left it like that. Like, you know. So you know me, because I produced all of that stuff, and a lot of people don't know. You know what I mean?
That's why I was asking you.
Was it harder being your own?
Well, it's that thing. It's that thing, bro. And I'm gonna tell you a question. I know you're trying to get me to dig into it. It's like, I will say, around that time, I didn't really ask for help. I just kind of thought that help should be volunteered. And I thought that, you know, at some point everybody would want me to realize my own potential. I mean, like, you know, because again, I didn't really feel like I was diminishing myself in any kind of way. I thought that it was just a vetting process, or like a preliminary, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like, some type of, you know, incubation kind of process that I was going through to get to a certain point. And that's not to discount or, you know, be condescending toward what we did or do collectively. You know what I'm saying? Like, I love the crew. I'll only ever show solidarity. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? Like, I'm built like that. Like, I'm a team kind of guy, just like you. Anytime I look at Jimmy Fallon, Quest, I love y'all, because I've known y'all for so long. And I'm like, look at that man. You know what I'm saying? Like, that man, you know, his team trust him. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? Like, they honor his word. I mean, like, they're ready to go into battle with him, win, lose, or draw. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? And when you ask who's that alpha male, I could, you know, that alpha individual, you know what I'm saying? Like, in our collective, no one wants to assume that position. You know what I'm saying? Like, so therefore, I will say this honestly and transparently, just so I can give you something raw. You know what I mean? Like, there's a great deal of appeasement that goes on internally. You know what I mean? Like, you know, to make sure that everybody, you know, that no equilibrium is offset. So I put my accomplishments on a shelf. You know what I mean? Like, when I come home to the collective, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like, I'm low. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm baby brother. I'm little bro. All humble of that. You say, you feel me? And yeah, I love that. You know what I'm saying? Like, because I like having OGs. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, that's my hard wiring. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? So I really don't mind. You know what I'm saying? Like, because I know at a moment's notice, I can go elsewhere and be whole on command. I can be whole. You know what I'm saying? And I'm only whole because crew is inclusive. Let me say that too. So the benefit of it is bilateral. I'm not whole without the collective. I love my guys.
So in the time that you leave the group and you start your solo career, of course, you know, Outkast, you know, they create this monstrous diamond album.
Yeah.
That's inescapable to the world as far as an eclipse. And then what happens with you is, like, in my mind, at least in 2003, I thought Hey Ya would just be a defining moment and that that would eclipse everything.
Yeah.
And then you come here with a new project with, like, the most, I mean, I would borderline say that the rival of Crazy and the kind of the term viral moments, viral, like Crazy, I almost feel is the first viral song, at least in the terms of which the word viral started to be used in everyone's lexicon.
And I'm not going to argue with you either.
Well, I mean, to the point like where, I mean, even Paris Hilton had her cover of it.
Yeah.
How uncomfortable was it for you to accept what I assume is a very unexpected moment, where I would assume that, like, Gnarls Barkley was just like, hey, let's just do a little cutesy side project with my weirdo friend Brian here. Exactly. And then I'll go do my third record, which incidentally, I mean, if anything, Fuck You probably surpassed Crazy. I don't know, like, numbers wise, what was more inescapable as far as the bigger song. Was it uncomfortable for you to finally get, like, the overdue kind of accolades due to you, especially from the environment you came from?
Yeah, because you were pretty much Andre 2999. I mean, like, like, for real, you know what I mean?
Oh, that's a quote for your ass.
I love it. No, but look, man. Okay, so no, I thought that it was dope. You know what I mean? Like, you know, that, you know, those two dynamics could come out of one crew. So therefore, I had always felt like it was, you know, it was fated. You know what I mean? Like, and it was, and we were favored. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I would love, you know, I can appreciate more and can benefit more with having him as an alliance as opposed to an opponent. You know what I mean? Like, at least we were, you know, alongside of each other. You know what I mean? Like, pushing mm-hmm. our agenda forward, you know, and waving our flag. You know what I mean? Like, you know, we shared the same flag. So, like, it's just like, you know, I know that it's typically just kind of one standout person. I mean, like, you know, you got one Jordan on the 90 whatever year fucking Bulls, the 93 Bulls or whatever. You know what I'm saying? And I definitely didn't consider myself a Pippin. You know what I'm saying? Like, and that's no insult to him. So very seldom, you know what I mean? Like, you know, it seems like chemically it would almost kind of blow up in your face to have a Kobe, you know, and can you imagine Kobe and Jordan on the same team?
On the same squad, like, you know, yeah.
You know,
the team would implode.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And even when we talk about Outkast being a trio, I could be rational and saying to myself, like, that might be too much. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? It might have been too much, you know? Right. And so I'm glad that whatever I could contribute was just enough to signify Goody Mob in the way that I aided it. You know what I'm saying? You know, because I did my part, and that's all that I'm there to do. So, in going forward, you know what I mean? Like, no, I didn't. I felt like everything was happening kind of right on time. You know what I mean? I felt like, you know, as long as I could be a success at being myself, I've got my whole life to do it. It didn't have to be, you know, it didn't have to be a facade, you know what I mean, like, or a freak of nature. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, I got a chance to just, you know, be that genuine article, you know, individual account of interpretive arts. You know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? Like, that's it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I got with Danger Mouse, and I knew that he was, you know, peculiar and eccentric, you know, much like myself, you know what I mean, like, in private. And I knew that, you know, our misery gave each other company. You know what I'm saying? You know, and when I heard his music, I think my only misery was the fact that, you know, I had not addressed this emotion sooner. You know what I mean? Like, you know, in my repertoire.
It took you, this long, like, you know, to get there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? But it was the timing was, you know, impeccable. You know what I mean? Because, like, I.
But how weird was the feeling of achieving a zenith and being number one? Like, is it a be careful for what you ask for a moment. Like, I'm certain that by week 18, you were tired of singing that damn song.
Well, I tell you this, it happened because you're right. It's one of those first viral moments. You know what I mean? Like, the first song to go to number one by digital download. I mean, like, it's got a Guinness World Record. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. This record. You know what I'm saying?
Crazy, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Crazy when I was
born. And to be totally honest, it was utterly calming and gratifying and relieving. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, because the inspiration for the song was, you know, all of those traumatic, you know, times that I could recall of being treated and seen and perceived, you know what I mean? Like, you know, as different or crazy or, you know, like all of that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? And then I could reflect on how it, you know, translated, you know, in my, you know, behavior at a time. You know what I mean? Like, you know, because that the video for Crazy is the Rorschach test.
The Rorschach test, yeah.
Yes. So Robert Hale, the director, I had a conversation with him, and this is where it came from. I was telling him about those times when I was in elementary school, middle school, and I would get pulled out of the class and taken into, you know, an office or empty room, and they would do those tests on me. You know what I mean? Like, wow. I didn't know what it meant. I wasn't really paying attention, you know, and I honestly can't recall if I was fledgling academically. I don't know what I was doing besides the behavior that I can recall that would make motherfucker think that I was, you know what I mean, like, needed to be prescribed Ritalin. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you and a lot of brothers like, at the time.
Yes. At
that time.
So, Crazy, the reason why it resonated in such a way, because it was so real and the resent was so deep in me. I hated being, you know what I mean, like, called crazy. You know what I mean? Like, you feel me? Or considered crazy. And so therefore, that's why it cut so deep for me. And I meant it so much. And I was so sincere. You know what I mean? And at that point, I was relieved. It's almost like I could have died. You know what I'm saying?
Wow. Well, then I'll ask you, did it sort of irk you a little bit once the song ran out of control and everybody and their mom had to cover it? I mean, there was country versions and
yeah,
Paris Hilton's version and like all these, like, did it take away from the specialness to
how
you?
How personal it was. Yeah.
Well, like Danger Mouse, he's, what's the word? He's neurotic in that way. He's what they call a purist. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's certain things he won't do, like, you know, he won't take a picture sitting on the left side of the ankle. You know, it's
right.
He's really pocket protector type. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we're both kind of nerds in our own way, but like, you know, he's a specimen of a person. I mean, like, you know,
what lesson did you learn in being in a group with him that you didn't utilize in being with Goody Mob that serves you better?
Can I tell you? He told me the greatest. I got two or three different things that he's told me. But he's a sweet guy. And you know, you would think he was like some dude that fucking is a vegan or something like that. But nah, like, all he eats is pizza and hamburgers and soda. You know what I mean? Like,
right?
he does look like a vegan dude.
I mean, he lives on a farm right now. I could have sworn that was
He lives on a farm in Connecticut. That's exactly where he is. Okay. But I'll tell you what he told me when I opened up the door. He said, hey, so before we get started, I want to say this. Hey, I am, you know, I'm obviously a fan of, you know, most of the work that you do. You know what I mean? And that's what he said. I'm a fan of most of what you do.
Okay, so you like four and songs on World Party. Thing, okay.
Right, yes. Right.
He said, so, but what I've noticed is there's a reoccurring thing that runs throughout your work, and there's this person trying to do and say so much good. You know what I mean? It's almost like you're trying to be redemptive for something. He said, so I said, he said, so it's my thinking that anybody trying to do that much good has done an equal amount of bad. And I want you to talk about that.
Yes. That's somebody who's been in therapy.
He called me out. He called me out. And I said, oh, okay. You know what I'm saying? And I just let it spill. And I just felt like, okay, he's a perceptive guy. And I remember when he was first playing me the tracks that ended up becoming St. Elsewhere, Gnarls Barkley debut album, a partner, a good friend of mine who I use as a barometer too, his name's Minte.
Minte Malone. Minte Malone.
Yeah, Minte. Yeah.
That's the homeboy. I was going to ask you about him. I was, what's going on with him, man?
He's still a homie. He with me. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, okay.
But he walked in the room to get something. He said, excuse me, guys, let me grab this right quick. I think he left some keys or his phone or something in the studio. And then, you know, in his own unique way, his personality, as he was walking out the door, he didn't look back, and the door was kind of slowly, you know, those studio doors, they'll go back hard and they'll come back soft. So the door was softly closing behind him. He said, by the way, whoever produced that track is crazy. You know what I'm saying? Like, so basically, he could feel the controlled chaos in that production, because I felt like that. I said, God damn. You know, I didn't say it to him. I said, but damn, this guy is damaged in a genuine way. You know what I mean? Like, I can tell. I'm like, who makes this stuff? You know, and then why is it speaking to me? So it spoke to my internal, you know, dialogue. You know what I mean? My internal chaos. And I was able to make some sense out of it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, alongside him. And I just felt like he's like a real partner in crime.
So one of my favorite songs on that record, which I always wanted to know if you'll ever explore more singing in your baritone voice.
On the line.
Yeah, on the line.
And like, how come you haven't decided to explore your lower voice? When I heard that, there's a song that I did with Bilal. As soon as I heard that, I ran to Bilal. Like, I was going to get with him in the studio, and I played it for him. I said, "Yo, dude, like, I want you to do the song in your lower register, because it's just something you never explored before, because everyone expects you to lose your mind on every song that you do."
That's right.
Like,
that's,
I want you to do a controlled song in your baritone. But yeah, like, how, but will you ever explore?
One of my favorite singers. Mm-hmm. He can sing so goddamn good. He's got, yeah. he's so trippy. Like,
yeah.
I got a chance to meet Bilal on a couple of different occasions. And I told him, I was like, yo, Sometimes is my favorite record from you.
Yes. Oh. Sorry. Yeah.
Nice.
Amir and Dick Boyce's
record. Anyway.
Yeah. Yes, compliments.
But, yeah. I'm shouting out Bella out.
Yes.
No, so I was just trying to amuse us, because I'll tell you the story, and it's not long. He came to Atlanta. We had about 8 days to go in. Out of pocket, independently, you know, and amuse ourselves. And that's what those sessions were like. You know, we're going through different tracks and this, that, and the third, you know. So if I couldn't get anything, like I said, that first day I came, I said, let me hear this, blah, 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 blah. And I went home and I wrote something. And then I wrote, I think, Just a Thought and Necromancer and something else. Mm-hmm. And I went back and he would only have these 2-minute loops. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to see, can I complete a thought, or can I get to a point of realization within those confines? You know what I mean? So that was, I had tasked myself in that way. But, you know, he had to go off to Iceland. So we were a little rushed, not really knowing really what to expect of each other. I'm just trying to hoping to get something. I mean, like, you know.
So the whole, y'all did that whole record in 8 days, the whole album?
Pretty much. You know what I mean? Like, you know. Yeah.
Sometimes the best work is done without thinking it, and you just. Yeah.
Just didn't think. Didn't think about it. You know what I mean? Like, it was.
No time to think.
Completely and totally unpretentious. I promise. It's the most honest, organic thing I've ever done. You know what I'm saying? That worked as well as it did.
Were you a Violent Femme fan, or was he a Violent Femme fan?
Well, I had
the Gone Daddy Gone cover that shocked me. I was like, oh shit.
Me too.
That was definitely his idea. I was familiar with Violent Femme from Blister in the Sun, and then more recently around that time was a song they had put out called Breaking Up, you know.
Right.
Breaking up.
Right. I know that, Jules.
Yeah. So I like that record. So I don't know what got into him to make him think that I don't know what he was doing. You know what I'm saying? But I trusted him in a very uncanny way. When he said what he said to me, I knew that I could trust him. On another occasion, he told me something else great. He said, "Lo, I guess because he was dealing with the executives and, you know, and people felt like, you know, sometimes when people are dealing with the producer, they think they're dealing with the checks and balances, the math of a situation. Like, you know, songwriting is science, and science is subject to interpretation. Math is matter of fact, and it's exact. So therefore, they'd rather talk to him than me." Yeah. So he was dealing with them, and I think he got a notion to say, he said, "Lo, man, everybody seems to be scared of you." And I'm saying, like, you know, because I was writing these songs, and people not knowing how genuine they are. I mean, like, it's like, goddamn, like, you know, like, this guy cool? Is he all right or what? And I'm saying, you know what I mean? Like, he said, "Everybody seems to be scared of you." He said, "But I'm not scared of you." He said, "As a matter of fact, when I'm with you, I'm not scared of anything."
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? So that's I want to quote him out loud in the world with that. I want that to reverberate, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, like all over, because that's one of the sweetest things anybody ever told me. You know what I'm saying? Like,
wow.
And you know, I'm like Shrek in my own little way. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? Like this
you the know, movie like, references, boy.
I'm like, people have taken me to be, because at a certain point, like when we got to the second Nas Rock the album, you know, then his ego started to kick in a little bit, and he kind of felt like he was Dr. Frankenstein, and I was, of course, Frankenstein. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
And I'm like, well, no. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, yeah. Like, you know, I'm smarter than that. You know what I'm saying? Like, you feel me, man? Right. Then I always find myself having to assert myself. And then when I get angry, then we got a problem.
Was it made the opposite way? Did you guys spend more time thinking it over and kind of less the approach that you did with the first record?
Okay, I'm going to say this. He had to leave. Through one of those sessions we were doing St. Elsewhere, he came in the studio. He gave me like two copies of the Gray album, which was the mashup that he did.
Yeah, the mashup joint with Jay.
And when that went out, it was like boom. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was like, wow. And then on the other side, I end up writing and producing Don'tcha for the Pussycat Dolls.
That's right. Yeah.
So
we got to get that story. I've always wanted to ask. We got to get that story, man. Like
at the time, after I left Pretty Mob and I had the two, I had Perfect Imperfections, I had Soul Machine. You know, they were critically acclaimed. Perfect Imperfections was nominated for a Grammy. NDRE ended up beating me out of that Grammy that year. I was nominated for a Grammy for that album. And she's my sister, so like it was all good. But I was kind of ready to walk away. I was like, yo, like, because I'm never really tripping about being seen or anything like that. Like, you know, as extroverted as I am, I don't really care, bro. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like I could write songs and, you know, and get quiet money and shut the fuck
yes.
up. And it's like, you know, like I don't, yo, I'm not tripping.
Necessary for Brandy. I love that. I just wanted to say before I forget the joint you wrote, Necessary. Yes. Nigga, I love that's my favorite.
So, hell yeah, I love that shit.
So you know, I'm surprised that she loved that record, but like, you know what I mean, like, you know, that's something that I would write for myself, but like that record spoke to her. And I'm like, Brandy, she's one of the greatest I love her voice. Ray J is my man. So like I've known her for years, and so anyway, that's that story. But no, you're right. So like I slipped into a songwriting kind of space. And I was like, well, I'll just do that. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? And I won't trip. But the Nas Rocky kind of, I didn't know if it would work. But again, it was just something recreational. I didn't really, you know, I didn't care. I mean, like, you know, and I wasn't as concerned, you know, but when you're not looking for it, that's when you find it. You know what I mean? Yeah.
And then y'all perfected y'all live show to like levels of, because I remember y'all did the Roots Picnic and it was amazing. Like,
We start kicking ass, y'all. Like, you know, and that's what happened. You know, like that journey that took me on a journey of 10 years, you know, between those two albums and touring. Like, you know, And, you know, then you're supplying, you find, and then it's not a dream anymore. It's a reality. But then you become, you know, preoccupied with the demand. You end up having to supply such a large demand. You know, it's ironic in a way of like, you know, you're working hard to kind of make that connection, you know, and then once you make it, you got to work three times as hard to supply. I mean, you feel me? Like, so anyway, no complaints.
I believe you're the only human being I know that, I don't know if it was at the height of crazy or not. Where is it? Dispel this rumor. Were you not in a room with both Prince and Michael Jackson at the same time?
Yes.
Can I tell you the story? I heard the story.
Did you hear Will I Am tell it?
No, I don't know where I heard. Maybe I read a blurb or something, but I heard a rumor and I was like, no, impossible.
I think you're probably the only bigger Prince fan than me than I can acknowledge or even have any knowledge of. But yes, like, you know, Prince is like my fairy godfather. I love him.
So
were in the room with both of them.
Okay, so the story goes, we were in Las Vegas doing something. I don't know what we were doing. Maybe we were on tour, but we ended up at a club and there was this beautiful woman there. She was dressed like, what do you call those ladies in the courtroom who's typing this stuff? What is it, like
stenographer.
Okay. She was dressed like a stenographer, hair pulled back in a tight bun, and she was gorgeous. And like, she didn't fit in whatsoever, right? So we walked to the back of the club and we're sitting there, you know, Erotic City comes on. Boom, boom, boom. And we're like, oh, shit, Prince, here we go. You know what I'm saying? Next thing you know, Prince walks through there. And we're like, oh, shit, that was Prince. And you, and if you know Prince, like I know him, then you know he always does this little smirk. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
It's just a little smirk that he does. And I was like, damn. You know, like, because at first the girl seemed so out of place. I'm like, what is she doing here? So anyway, it turns out that she was with him and she was some artist. He ended up putting a record out on her. She was gorgeous. I don't remember her name, though. But anyway,
was one of them. Yeah, it was a lot.
Yeah,
of
something like that. Like, so he called me. So he sent the security over. They called me over, and he said that he loved Crazy. He said he listened to the album. He listened to Saint Elsewhere. He said, I must admit though, it scared me a little. Mm. And I said, it scared you? And I'm like, I thought that was so amazing because I'm like, that's how I got into Prince because he scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. Like, you know what I mean? Like, but right. I was drawn to him. There's a song called Annie Christian that scared Christian, me to death.
On Controversy.
Talks about Atlanta.
Yes. It does. Thank you.
Right.
You know, so that song was unnerving to me. I don't know why, but you know, that's him. That's the magic of him. But anyway, we exchange contacts. He gets in contact with me. And he's doing his Vegas residency at the Rio Hotel in the round room. So this room is made like a circle, okay? So I'm there. I get invited down there to perform Crazy with him at his residency. Me and Will were cool, too, at the time. We were talking a lot more frequently. And he said that he was going to be there. So we got there. And, you know, Will was in Vegas working with Michael Jackson, you know, doing something. So we're there, I do Crazy with Prince and Will does whatever he does. And I don't know what it was. I can't remember what record it was, just maybe some vamp that they were doing. Prince gets on the bass and it looks like the longest neck bass I've ever seen. Like it was fucking.
Well, Prince is also like 5'0". So
exactly.
Any bass is taller than Prince.
So he walks out into the room. And this is before I knew Michael Jackson was there. So he walks out and the spotlight is on him and he gets right in front of Michael Jackson's table. And I promise you, the tip of that bass was touching Michael Jackson's nose. And he's And he sat there, he slapped that bass for about 2 or 3 minutes. Bang, 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 bang.
What Michael Bass look like, though? Michael ain't no punk.
And so that was that.
But what did Michael's face look like? Because he ain't no punk.
He like, I'm Joe Jackson's son, goddamn, hold up.
Michael Jackson ain't no punk, and that's a fact. You know what I'm saying? Like, but I guess he was kind of looking like, he was like, yo, this dude just won't quit, man. You know what I'm saying? Like, this has been years, Prince. I don't got no problem with you, bro.
Got no peace.
I don't want no smoke with you, little man. But I met, you know, so that was like my second physical time meeting Prince. The first time at that club that night, the meeting and greeting with him at the show. But that was my first and only time meeting Michael Jackson. And Michael Jackson, when he stood up, Michael Jackson, for those who don't know, he's like 10 feet tall.
He's tall?
He's tall. With huge hands. He's like an alien, dude. Like, you mean, like, he looks like the Predator. He's a big dude.
And see, like, you're not saying, well, okay.
What? No, not nothing bad.
I'm just saying, because y'all like the opposite in that way. Like, you may be a little, and then, never mind. No, it's true. Your hands and his hands.
He's way taller than me. So, like, I'm having to look up to him. I'm like, wow. And so that's Michael Jackson, but I did get a chance to meet him really, really, really briefly because we all had to walk backstage and you know, Prince took off into the night and then, you know, once the show was over, he disappeared as he usually does. As I came to realize that's his signature move. I got another crazy Prince story too, I tell you.
Say it.
Run it.
We live for it.
Oh, no, dude. Okay, so one time it was, you know, he would do these after Grammy parties. And right. So, you know, this was the year that I did Fuck You. I did it with Gwyneth Paltrow and I had on the chicken suit. You remember
yeah,
that?
Like, wow. John, yeah, like John, that joint. I was there.
Yeah, I was my homage to Elton John. Okay, so I was sitting out in the audience watching the rest of the show and he had somebody come around tapping different people who he felt like, you know, he wanted to invite to the house. So we got the address. Yeah. So we got the address, and we ended up going over there. Like I remember, Maxwell was there, Dave Chappelle was there, so you can hear the music downstairs, and we were just kind of talking. You know, I didn't rush right downstairs. And I'm looking around and didn't see Prince. He's like, "Well, he's down there playing music." So I go downstairs, and as soon as I come in the door, it's like a path is made for me, and Prince is directly in front of me. But he's playing bass. He's like, come here. He gestures to me to come here. He says, pick a song. So anytime he's ever been depicted a certain kind of way, like Dave Chappelle doing him on Chappelle Show. That's exactly how he is. You know what I mean? Like, he said, pick a song. I'm like, okay. So it's this big book of song lyrics printed out. And, you know, I picked something easy that I knew and it was Superstition. So I sang Stevie Wonder's Superstition. You know, and so in the process of me, you know, that song is 4 minutes long, you know what I mean? Like, you know, give or take. And in that process, he got off the bass, got on the drums, went and mixed my vocal and did some other shit. I'm saying, you feel me? So I was like, damn.
Not a 4 minutes on in his world.
You know what I'm saying? And so I had some friends with me and he was gracious enough to have us there. So as the night went on, we're partying. You know, and you know, people it's kind of started fanning out. So we end up staying there all night. You know what I mean? Like, so I sat and talked with him and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so
did he try to convert you to hand out
Jehovah's Witness?
Yo, man, you feel on the pitfall. You feel on the trap. Whenever he starts I'm like, I'm out. Check, please.
That's what we talked about. That's what we sat there and talked about, Jehovah's Witness. I said, okay. You know, so that was that. And then, look, so this is around the time, Quest, I'm sure you'll know, he had that little two-door black Cadillac, looked like the Batmobile. You know, you remember that one?
I know. Okay. It. Yes.
It's 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. It's that real hazy looking like Hotel California, you know what I'm saying, like coming out. You know, we drunk and been high and all that kind of stuff. You know what I'm saying? So not him, but us. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah. I know. Trust me. Everyone knows.
So with that, we're coming out of the door, and then my homeboy says, "Yo, did y'all see Prince?" I said, "No, where is he?" He was jumping into the car. So the garage door was up, but you could see the car, the Cadillac. He said, "He just got in that Cadillac right there." Okay, so imagine if we're parked immediately across the street. So the driveway is here, you know, the car is right there, the mailbox is right here. He takes off out of the garage, and he almost runs us over.
What? What?
Man, look, I wish it could be. It's kind of crazy now that I'm saying it, but like, it was funny for us then because it was just, I mean, it was like, what is he doing? Where is he going? Isn't this his house? Where's he going?
His heel, you know, probably got stuck. It's all right.
So, but no, he wasn't trying to hit us, but so he cuts out of the driveway real quick. Whoop! And he makes a left, and we're parked like facing up the hill because we only know of one entrance into that subdivision.
Right.
I don't know where he was going, if he was making a left. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right. Where could you go?
Where are you going, man? It's 7 o'clock in the morning. Why are you?
If civilization's to the right, why was he going to the left?
He knows what's something wrong? Y'all don't. He knows something y'all don't.
I just think the reason why it's just cool, because I just think that it was just to give us kind of something to be talking about right now, you know, 12 years later. I mean, like, he just gave us a little question mark, a little mystery. It was great.
He always does that. Does weird shit just to, I know it'll be a story later. He did this shit to us once where I think the last time I saw him, he changed his outfit twice.
Did he?
For no reason. It was literally just, he had one outfit on, came back in, had another outfit on, and then like 10 minutes later, came back with another outfit on. as if it were nothing.
I love
and,
it.
Yeah, that was the strangest shit to me. So I want to get to your newest album.
Okay.
Now this is produced by
Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys.
First of all, I hear a lot about Memphis, Tennessee. Brian Danger Mouse himself has tried to sell me on how amazing it is in Tennessee and how there's a music community down there and how there's all this, you know, the songwriting community and musicianship and studios and vintage studios. So yeah, why the move to record in Tennessee?
Well, it's Nashville actually, and we befriended each other because they came and supported us and checked out the show. 1 year we were doing South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, and that's how we befriended the Black Keys. And then shortly thereafter, Danger ended up producing their album Brothers with I'm a lonely boy. So that he produced that album with them or for them or something like that. So anyway, I ended up bumping into him some years later in London. We both were performing on Jules Holland, if you're familiar.
Oh, yeah. Jules. Yeah.
Later with Jules Holland.
Yeah. So we were doing that. And we exchanged numbers because his set was so cool. He had this all-female mariachi band. And I was like, yes. Oh, damn, that shit sounds great. Yes. Mm-hmm. I befriended them too. You know what I mean? So with that, then he reached out to me maybe like, you know, 6 months or 4 months, something later, and just asked me to come to Nashville, you know, to write. He said, I appreciate you as a songwriter. You know what I mean? And maybe we can get together, get in the room, collaborate on some stuff. And, you know, that's basically, you know, the gist of it. And then I said, okay, cool. This is Dan from the Black Keys. I mean, like I dig them, you know, the time was right. I was available, you know, it's a 30-minute flight from Atlanta. I'm like, cool. I mean, like, so I went and it was strange because I wasn't really sure, like, you know, but you know, everybody was there and you know, check-in was like 11 o'clock in the morning. Of which I've never recorded anything that early in the day. You know what I mean? Like, you know, so I'm like, okay, 11 o'clock. But we will only go from like 11 to 4, you know what I'm saying? 11 to 4 or 5. and I didn't understand. I mean, and I kind of was getting a little irritated with it for the first few days. I'm like, I don't really know what's going on. We just kind of, you know, so we would sit around the table and you know, kind of writing songs and recording voice memos into the phone and, you know, with a ukulele or an acoustic guitar or Wurlitzer, you know. So, you know, it was really quaint, you know what I mean? Like, you know, and simple, you know, country living was the approach, you know. And so over 6 months, I went back maybe like a week, about 4 weeks total. So maybe like a month out of the 6 months, I went and went down there for a week. And I asked him, I said, yo, I said, what's up with 11 o'clock in the day? I'm like, is that like the magic hour? I'm like, what's that? And he was like, no. He said, well, all of these musicians, man, you know, they're in there like their 70s. You know what I mean? He said, so like, yeah. You know, he said, man, quite frankly, man, like, you know, they like to be done early. And, you know, I kind of got to, you know, need to try to get as much as I can get out of them, man. You know, we don't have them forever. You know what I'm saying?
Oh,
yeah. And I was like, God damn, I didn't realize that. Because I didn't really realize who they were. Because he didn't really give me any disclaimer that in his mind, he was recording the greatest soul album of all time on CeeLo Green. You know, So he only told me that he wanted to write songs. So I'm thinking, I'm like, yeah, we're going to get some of this country music money and blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm thinking of it like that. You know, and again, I was again at another point in my career where, like, I'm tired of being CeeLo Green. I just kind of want to be me. I mean, like, I'm older. You know, I'm an elder statesman. I want to be refined in a way of where now, you know, I could just go by my name. So I had contemplated doing a Prince and not being referred to as CeeLo Green anymore. I'm like, I'll just be Calloway. You know, so the way that my granddaddy was called, like, you know what I mean? Thomas Calloway. I said, because, you know, it's about legacy now. Anything I do from this point on is about legacy. And, you know, the legacy isn't last name. You know what I mean? So I've been telling press that Thomas Calloway writes the songs that CeeLo Green sings. So I only went as Thomas Calloway to be a writer. And then so that last week he said, hey, man, I was thinking, you know, we've got some good ideas, you know. You think maybe you could come back and maybe, like, you know, cut a few of them just to kind of see how your voice sounds on them. And I was like, you know, that's not really what we discussed, but I'm like, cool. I'll sing them. You know what I'm saying? You know, why not? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I went down and unbeknownst to me, he's got a studio full of all of these great, legendary Nashville Muscle Shoals, you know, musicians who played on all of this wonderful music. You know what I mean? Like, and I really didn't know because he didn't give me any disclaimer, you know, about who they were, nor did he give me a disclaimer about that he was secretly recording an album on me.
Yeah, so the names, David Rowe, Bobby Wood, you know, I know Bobby Wood played on Kris Kristofferson's.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff. And so, I know, Russ. Russ Powell as well.
Yep. So with that, you know, that was my first time recording with charts. I was familiar with all of the songs that we had written over the last 3 weeks, you know, but I had never sung them besides those kind of voice references, you know, in his phone. But, you know, he had went and printed out sheet music, I mean, charts and everything. I mean, like, so by the time I got there, you know, I'm looking at the songs. I'm like, okay, look, I remember this one. And then so I got one eye on the paper, the lyric sheet, and then I got one eye on watching them play it all down flawlessly. You know what I mean? So it gave me, my disposition was really humbled, you know, as opposed to going in there with any airs or any ego. You know what I mean? So, like, you know, this album is completely unpretentious. That's why I like it so much. You know what I mean? So it's basically like Dan Auerbach's gift to me.
So you made an album without knowing you were making a record.
Absolutely. And I recorded that album in 2 days because I just sung the songs we had. It was just that easy to do.
Yeah.
I wish I could do everything like that.
Man, I want to ask you always about Stray Bullets. That's one of my favorite projects of yours, man.
Come on, bro. You know what about that?
Come on, man. You singing over the stereo shit. Talk about that. What was doing that record?
I was just talking to my management. I said, like, yo, I need to re-release Stray Bullets.
Yes, like for
because
real.
Enough people didn't hear it. Okay, so what it was.
That was where I found out that CeeLo, that Cujo could play the sax because you had him on break. Nothing shocks me anymore.
Well, I got to ruin it for you because I was just teasing. I said that because at that time, you know, we were kind of all estranged from each other. And Cujo was just dealing with the accident. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he lost his foot.
So I just was, I was loving on him in that way. Cujo was good on the sax, y'all. You know what I'm saying?
I thought that was really him.
No. So I went to London to do Lady Killer, that record, you know, and it was all of this northern blue-eyed soul, you know what I mean? They kind of like sold by numbers. I didn't particularly enjoy it, nor did I really, you know, did I think it was good. I mean, like, you know, but
even though one of your biggest hits came from it?
No, absolutely. No, I was wrong. I was totally wrong.
By the way, what was the impetus of that? You just said, I got a great song title called Fuck You, and the label was like, yes, we see it. This is a hit.
Okay, no, I'm gonna tell you about that too. So check this out. All right, so I'll tell you the first story. You know, I was trying, we recorded for like 3 years trying to get that record. You know what I'm saying? And I had done all of that stuff. So when I was like Straight Bullets, I got that idea from a Devo album called Greatest Misses instead of Greatest Hits. Greatest Hits, you know what I'm saying? And Straight Bullets was just like, yo, I'm just going to bust these off, you know, like, and they hit somebody. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? But I had done a lot of music, and I really wasn't getting that. I wasn't having it reciprocated, you know what I mean, like, by the label the way that I wanted. And I'm just like, damn, y'all ain't fucking with none of this? And so I put that mixtape out to spite them of all of that material because it was the last album. It was supposedly, you know, at that time with Atlantic, you know what I mean? But they ended up picking up the option. I ended up doing one more album with them, Heart Blunt. So I just said, like, well, yo, I mean, like, I just do a mixtape and I just leaked it. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? And that's why I didn't really get any kind of a clown. That's why I'm surprised you're even mentioning it. But man, Tyler, the creator, loves it too. You know what I mean? Like, that's one of the dopest projects I ever did. So I found all of this public domain library music, you know what I mean? Like, to where it wasn't really, you couldn't really have any copyright infringement, like, you know, clauses and all like that. So I just did songs to that stuff and just, you know, it was just amusing myself. No different than I put out a project called TV on the Radio too.
Oh, yeah. The shit you sung over the Peanuts theme.
Yeah.
There's little children. Man, I love that shit, dude. That shit's so hard.
I gotta hear that shit. I didn't hear it.
I'll send it to you, man. Like, you know, some of it is out there, like on YouTube, but they snatched it down because, of course, you know, I didn't clear it or nothing like that. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was just ingenious. You know what I mean? Like, and sometimes I have to almost, like, that's my little sparring match with myself to kind of get something out before I try to, you know, be so subservient to what they, you know, all of the many cooks in the kitchen with the major label shit. Like, I didn't enjoy it. So I'm much happier, you know, being an independent artist again. Last time I was independent, you know, Gnarls and Don't You and all that kind of stuff came from me being able to have enough space, you know what I mean, like, to do what I want to do.
Oh, no, man, what happened with the record? So you had a project, you had a bunch of side projects that I want to ask you about. You had the Heart
Jazzy
Attack.
Faye? Oh, Heart Attack.
Heart Attack with Jack Splash, but then the Jazzy Faye record, I had it. It was the Happy Hour.
Happy Hour.
Happy Hour. Because y'all had the joint, the Enjoy Yourself with you, Jazzy, and Nate Dogg.
Nate Dogg, yeah.
Nigga. What happened? Okay, look.
That project is
that
basically
was my cookout
still
music.
Brand
I was
new,
ready for that album.
I love that album so much. I told him the other day, I called him. I said, like, yo, since everybody is going on Zoom and shit, I said, like, let's go on and call it the Happy Hour and just play the unreleased album. You know what I mean? We're supposed to do it. He may still be up for it, but we didn't do it. But anyway, I'll tell you what happened with that. I was recording that at the same time as I was recording Gnarls Barkley.
Oh, okay.
So he had a deal with Capitol Records that was supposed to be for a solo album with him or a compilation album, Jazzy Faye and Friends. And then we met up in Miami and we did a couple of songs. He's like, oh, shit, like, nah, this is the move. So he switched it out. So like, no, I'm gonna do a CeeLo, you know, me and CeeLo album or this, that, and the third. So the album is so dope. It still holds up even after all of these years. But what he did was, you know, we recorded it all just at our leisure, but we never signed a deal for it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, gotcha. By the time we had a whole album done, we went on a promo tour, we did Soul Train, we shot a video. you know, but we never signed a deal. Wow. And so I'm going across the street. I'm leaving those sessions, like going to see Danger Mouse for a couple of hours, you know, and I always get a little irritated with it because, like, you know, after a while you want to go into it optimistically and diplomatically, but, like, you know, sometimes I'm just like, yo, like, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? Like, you know, I don't want to, whatever. I mean, like, so that was that. But when Gnarls Barkley hit, because it just hit all of a sudden. It was like, boom. Mm-hmm. And then they had to shelf the project because it wasn't no deal. You know what I mean? Like, and quite frankly, it just couldn't compare. You know what I mean? Like, now to ask a question about fuck you. Mm-hmm. All right. So what happened was when I was in L.A., I recorded Lady Killer in Miami, LA, and London. They gave me a blank check to do whatever I wanted to do after Crazy. So I was everywhere trying to get that record. And we ended up getting it. You know what I'm saying? Like, so Mike Caron introduced me to who's now known famously as Bruno Mars. At the time, they were introducing me as Phil and Bruno. That was how they were kind of circulating. Phil right. Lawrence was his writing partner at that time. You know what I mean? So I was working at Nightbird Studios at the Sunset Marquee in L.A. They came over, and I'm like, what's up? You know what I mean? Like, you know, I didn't really know them. I didn't know what they did, and I just was kind of letting them hear some of the stuff that I was working on and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, you know, maybe you could try this or blah, blah, blah. I'm like, man, who the fuck is y'all?
That sound like you, Sheila.
So I told him, I said, you know what, bro? I'll be right back. I gotta use the restroom. So I went upstairs to the room and I just never came back. And I just left him in the studio. And I've said this a couple of times because I was being really rude. I didn't really know. I didn't know them. I didn't know them to respect them. But
lessons learned, CeeLo.
But then we rectified that. We got back together. Bruno had a lot of love for me and, you know, kind of looked at me as a mentor. And if you guys pay attention, you'll realize that, you know, he was kind of built off of my back. You know what I'm saying? You know, because, you know, he wrote Just the Way That You Are for me.
You rejected that?
Well, yeah, because I didn't think it was for me. But right. Yeah, I didn't see it for me. No different than, you know, he started Fuck You. And then we ultimately, you know, me and Phil came in because he had the day of the session. We went over. He said, like, yo, I got this idea. He said, man, you know, it's a little crazy, but just bear with me. And it was like, you know, it was just a hook. I see you driving around town with a girl I love. And I'm like, fuck you. And I'm like, oh, okay. But see, at that time, this is bring straight bullets back into the conversation. At this time, I was kind of pissed. This is 3 years later. And I'm like, yo, I can't get no satisfaction. I'm so ready to say fuck you to the label, to everybody. So to me, Fuck You was essentially a protest song to the label. You know what I mean? I thought it was ridiculous enough for them to drop me. That's why I was so enthusiastic about doing it.
It worked.
Can I tell y'all how quick it worked, bro? I'm gonna tell you. We had to go to London to do some fucking promo or something. And I think Fuck You may have been the first song to introduce lyric sheets with printing out the lyrics at real time with the music. I had never seen it before.
YouTube,
that.
Right.
Yeah. So
wow. Shit.
So with that, I think I want to say it was the first one, bro. And I'm not tripping, but
it came fast and
it came like, so fast, bro. It came like, okay, so we had to get on a plane and go to London. By the time we landed in London, it was a hit.
Wow.
So that's 8 hours. So like basically like in 8 hours, that shit was a hit, bro.
Well, you talk about songs that you know, that you didn't think were for you. Is there a version of you singing Happy by Pharrell?
It is. Mm. Okay. Okay. So we were-
How'd you know?
My homie Amir Windham, he was working with Pharrell at the time. But I heard that it was originally Pharrell wrote it for you. And so I always wondered if there was a version of you singing it, of a reference, whatever.
I tell you the story. Me and Pharrell been friends and collaborators for a long time.
Yeah, he was on your second album. He was on the Soul Machine.
So with that, he was doing Despicable Me 2, and I was in the Bahamas in Eleuthera recording Heart Blunt. That's, I think Lenny Kravitz owns that island because he was there. He came by the house.
Yeah.
I know he lives there. I don't know if he owns it, but so we was there and he came down on his own dime, you know, to kick it and be a part of it. And he played it for me. And, you know, me, it was just, he played for me with the disclaimer that it was about to be a part of a Disney Pixar movie. You know what I mean? Like, you know, mm-hmm. So I didn't see it like for what it became, but there is a version of where I sang it, you know, and the version that you hear is the demo that he made, basically his emulation of my voice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, so I don't know if I sound like that, but maybe I do. Maybe, you know, whatever.
That's the first time I'm hearing.
So, yeah, we got that version. Yeah, but I said, you know, in the press, I was just like, I know that Pharrell has had, some solo success as an artist, but, you know, mainly as a producer. But for what that record ultimately ended up becoming, I'm like, you know, and he was about to be generous enough to give that record away. I said, so I believe that that's the universe rewarding his selflessness. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, because he was, you know, he was definitely pushing for it to be my record. And right. the politics behind it, I tell you, Atlantic Records, they wouldn't clear it for whatever reason. I think because we were about to go with another single. And, you know, I think Despicable Me wanted single rights for it at the time, and they didn't want it to conflict. So, you know, that it was logical, their decision, but of course you can't win them all. You know what I mean? Like, and that's really what happened. You know what I mean? And so I guess he decided to just put it out, and then it kind of, you know, it worked as a record on the soundtrack, but then I guess when he shot the visual, that's when the record really came to life.
That's when it took off. Because he had the hat, and then he had people all over like the world kind of doing it. Like it
was, oh, that's right. The 24-hour video.
The 24-hour joint. Yeah. Yeah. Man, yo.
Go
ahead. Yo, no, it was a record. I wanted to ask you that is the
people
shit I'm
hated
loving right now.
That record had to be mine, though, by the way.
I was about to
you
say,
think so?
I wasn't
been
really
overkill.
Ready. I was about to
it
say.
Been, oh, thank you. It thank been
I wasn't overkill. Ready to hear that much happiness from CeeLo.
They would have hated me. I knew it. I'm so glad you guys said that. I'm so glad I just remembered to say that. I said, I'm glad it's not mine. I said, that's his record. It belongs
plus
to him.
Plus, the things that Pharrell had to do around that record, like the promo, the stages that he had, I was like,
it was a lot.
It was a lot.
I'm sure he probably doesn't enjoy doing that record to this day. I'm sure
he hates
that
part.
Yo, man, tell us about the record you did with it just came out, I think like last year. Intentions, you, Big Boy, and Sleepy.
I'm gonna tell
love
you
that
about
fucking
that too.
Song, man. Dude, I need more of that. I love that fucking song.
Okay, so check this out. We were all in a room, the entire Dungeon family, Dre 3000 included. You know, he was about to come on board to do another Dungeon Family album. And we were going to do it. But exactly. We were even like fingers crossed, like, really, Trey? So after that, L.A. Reid and everybody, we want to do L.A. Reid and Hit Call. So, and I'm telling this story for the first time. So we were all there. Everybody's there, you know, and so just to, you know, on good faith, you know, after L.A. left the meeting, you know, Ray from Organized North started pulling up some tracks. And, like, we all at the studio. We all up at Stankonia, like, playing some tracks. And I said, ooh, what's that? And I'm thinking, like, the Sleepy Brown said to me, yo, he said, actually, I already got kind of like a little idea today. And he got in my ear like, yo, I got an intention. Right? So I said, okay. I said, I like that. Let me dance with you on it. You know what I'm saying? I said, I got something. I said, I'm going to go in the booth and just rock real quick. So just off the top of the head, because it felt like Loose Ends to me. You know what I mean?
It's like Loose Ends meets Cold Blooded by Rick James. Like that's
right. Mm-hmm. So that's how I ended up having those two parts on there. I had the the top part and then the end verse.
That's all you saying in there. Then all you disappear. Yeah. He was focused on that shit.
We thought that it would probably just kind of, it was a little incentive for the Dungeon Family project. I'm saying like, you know, okay. But Sleepy Brown and Big Boy were working on a project simultaneously called The Big Sleepover at the time. And that's where the original idea came from. So all of a sudden, in days' time, you're like, yo, we're going to shoot a video for this and make this a single. I'm like, really? I'm like, damn, we're just fucking around. But I'm like, but okay, I'm glad y'all like it. And that's kind of where it came from. And then we were slated to do the Dungeon Family album. But then again, you know, I think Dre ended up having to go off and film. It's a show that he's doing.
The Dispatches from Everywhere, the AMC show. It. The one in, so, yeah.
Philly, right?
Philly one.
Yep. Right? Yeah. Yep. They kind of took the wind out of the sails. I gotta say that. But he was already slated to do it. You know what I'm saying?
Does Sleepy Brown understand that people need, that people want more Sleepy Brown in their life? Does he really understand that? I feel like because he put that one album out and maybe he didn't get the response he wanted, but like people fucking love Sleepy Brown.
No, for sure. He's a legend, man. Like, you know, he's a part of so many iconic things pertaining to Goody. I mean, excuse me, pertaining to Dungeon. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's big bro. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I love Sleepy. He's one of my close friends.
But he just needs to know. Tell him the people want it. I'm just saying.
I'm going to tell him. I'm going to let him know.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to tread on very careful ground with this last question.
Okay.
Because this is sort of a comeback for you. And
yes,
not to mention, I guess the motif of your life is kind of series of second chances or another chance or another, you know, like you escaping situations.
Yes.
Because we live in a time right now with what's going on in the world today. And, you know, we live in the era of cancel culture.
Yes.
And it's almost like what it seems as though, like, I guess the idea of cancel culture is like, well, you can never come back or you can never redeem yourself or you can never return to your prominence or what once was. How are you able to navigate the last 10 years of your life just in terms of, because usually when a person has to go through that process, and it's a nightmare. Like even now, I wake up every morning at 5 a.m. just to look at trending topics to make sure I'm not on that list. Like,
yes.
No, because I'm thinking like, is there an interview I did or something that, you know, and I know, you know, but
not sure.
That's literally how, you know, I'm not exaggerating when I'll say at least 5 times a day, I got to check just to make sure. Okay.
No, I got you.
I'm good.
I got you.
So, and it's stressful and it's stressful, but it's very real. How are you able to navigate your life in the last 10 years with your loved ones, with your family, with yourself to get to this place? Like, what have you learned in the last 10 years?
I've learned the circumstance of celebrity and fame and fortune. All of these things are very fragile and precious. You know, it must be handled with care and consideration and cognizance. You know what I mean? And so it is an intoxicating experience all throughout, especially to succeed in that space. And, It's a surreal experience, and you know, it can be dizzying. And you can oversight things that are, you know, or things that could very well possibly put you in compromising positions, you know, because you know, fame or celebrity is a compromising position. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's what it qualifies as. You know, what I've learned, you know, over the last several to 10 years is to be still. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I reconnected, you know, with community. I reconnected with the social conscious themes and aspects of myself that were purifying and refining, you know, and I realized that success had taken me so far away from those things. I spend an awful lot of time with my son. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I'm really making up for a lot of lost time with him. Because, you know,
how old is he now?
He's 19.
He's 19. Oh, wow, damn, our son's the same age. That's crazy.
Yeah. You know, so the spoils of success, you can share in the wealth, you know what I mean? Like monetarily, materially, you know, but it does not equate to tangible time. You know what I mean? And so I just got close to family. I got close to cause, philanthropy and charity, and associated myself with different causes that I was passionate about, and started to lose sight of myself or shed the celebrity skin. You know what I'm saying? And give myself away to those things that I deem to be greater than what I had even accomplished, because, you know, it's not an end all be all to be alone. You know what I'm saying? Like to be, you know, accomplished, but alone and alienated. You know what I mean? Like I did not start out on this journey to look back and no one be there, no one to share it with. You know what I mean? If anything, I had experienced, you know, far too much alienation as an adolescent, and the music was a way to express and make myself relative, to connect to people, to finally be counted as a part of a collective, you know what I mean, like, or a community, and belong. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because I wasn't really made to feel like that as a kid. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So I just reconnected with those things and was really, and if you know, like, even with, we mentioned Beautiful Skin earlier, you know what I'm saying? Like, in the way that was effective in Philly, it's like, I was really expecting people to know me and know my history and where I'm coming from, and know that, like, I don't got nothing but love in my heart and decency, you know what I'm saying? And humanity and humility. I'm one of the most well-rounded and grounded people you'll ever meet. You know what I'm saying? Like, loving and generous and selfless, you know what I mean? And I could only hope that it translates in song. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and then I'll go in the extra mile. You know what I mean? Like, you know, for good measure, to make sure, you know, that I'm under the skin. You know what I mean? Like, you know, of those that, you know, to whom it may concern. You know what I mean? Like, all of my music has just been a love letter to those to whom it may concern. You know what I mean? So I'm glad for, and I'm very fortunate for, to start off as a, you know, pretty much a Black nationalist, you know what I mean? Like, damn near borderline racist. You know what I'm saying? Like, with Goody Mob. You know what I mean?
You can't be racist, but yes.
You know what I'm saying. You know, but to ultimately evolve into a, you know, that universal appeal. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like, and I'm telling you, it's almost impossible, you know, to fake it. Like, to, you know, to fake that. You know what I'm saying? Like, with these audiences that I've encountered and that I've acquired. You know what I mean? Like,
your Goody Mob audience holds you accountable for things in a way? Because probably the Nas Barkley audience is a little, you got different audiences.
And I feel like,
yeah.
Well, the thing of it was, I should have just worked in double shifts. Like, that's kind of what I was meaning earlier when I said I had to go out into the world and supply that large demand. You're talking about, I could have moved to London. If you go to London, you know, all you're gonna hear is, you know, from everything from Amy Winehouse to Etta James on just regular radio, and not even categorized, like all in one mix. It's just like open format radio.
Yeah.
Quest knows I'm right. He knows I'm telling the truth. So
I live there.
I love it.
I know that.
I loved it in London. And when I got there and I got a chance to spend a considerable amount of time there, I understood why they loved me. And I said, God damn it. Like, this is where I belong. And I heard Lenny Kravitz say years ago in an interview, he said, man, like, I know that I've accomplished a great deal. He said, but if there's any one thing that I can say that I truly wanted, that would make me happy, is to make music that my own people, you know what I'm saying, like, can appreciate. You know what I'm saying? And that's what I felt like. I mean, like, because when it was time to be Black, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I felt like I with that me, Goody Mob, you know, Beautiful Skin. I felt like we was making the blackest music you can make.
I was about to say, but don't you feel like you have that privilege over Lenny in a way, because you ushered in your Goody Mob audience to everything that you did. Everybody didn't come, but a lot of people did, which is the difference between you and Lenny in that way, right? Because your audience evolved with you.
It's true. It wasn't a definitive separation of church and state. It was a bridge between church and state.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm fortunate for that. I'm very fortunate for that. So it's no different than Fuck You is the lead off single. Mm-hmm. But I got 2 Grammys for Fool For You with Melanie from Fiona. Right. You know
Bodies
what I'm saying?
Was my record off that album. That was my
and
favorite.
Bodies. That's the big homie, Salam Remy. You know what I'm saying? So the way that album started, it was supposed to be my big black R&B record. Fuck You, Bodies, you know, Fool For You. And some of the stuff that you heard on Straight Bullets.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it would have been like. You know what I mean? But again, I don't have any regrets in retrospect, because like it all worked out so well. You know what I mean? And even question, just to cap off the question, you know, like I, even with everything that I've endured through, you know what I mean? Like, you know, good, bad, and indifferent, I have very few complaints. I'm saying like, because there's truly no testimony without the test.
Not even Marriage Boot Camp?
What about
that? I forgot about
you
that.
You said no regrets.
Well, you know what? Guess what though? Marriage Boot Camp was almost kind of like a re-entry point for me.
Yeah, it was.
People got a chance to see me, you know, in a light that they had not. I'm saying like, you know, me domestically and with my woman, like, you know, I'm going to say this straight up to y'all. Like, you know, there was a period of time when people thought maybe I was gay or something. You know what I'm saying? You know, like because of the outfits and the wigs and, you know, stuff like
that's
that.
That's the over-masculinity of hip hop. But yeah, mm-hmm. That's over-masculinization of hip hop. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Nah, it ain't that. But I put up. I'm right with you.
You don't think a little bit?
Nah, I mean, for starters, I never thought that CeeLo was gay. You know
me
mean?
Neither. I'm like, but
to me, when I saw the big outfits, it was just like, you know, it was like, you know, Earth, Wind, and Fire. And
we're different people.
It was costume, yeah. It was different.
But the hardest nigga, he might have had a moment like, what the fuck? That ain't, you know what I'm saying?
But see, the thing of it was just like, people, and that's the love and affinity people have for Goody Mob in that era of my career. It's like, you know, they ain't letting that shit go easily. You know, like, you know, because we were affected. We touched people. And that's why, you know, that's why I always return to it. You know what I mean? Like, I could never sleep easy or rest well in letting any of my extended family down. I got to just do it all. You know what I'm saying? And that goes back to what I was saying, basically. Like, I just, the only thing I didn't do right is just work double shifts. Make sure that both sides of the brain were attended to and both sides of the spectrum were satisfied. You know what I'm saying? You know, because I got so overwhelmed and preoccupied with such a big deal on one side of it that it just tipped the scale one way. And that's what happened with me.
Well, from a fan perspective, I'm gonna tell you, we just happy to hear that you admit to that. Like, that's dope.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just asking, was that an alienating time for you? Like, how, like, when you have an incident and then, you know, everyone is just, you know, you kind of go through the cancel culture thing. When you're by yourself, you know, what's going through your mind, like, during all of that?
To be totally honest, I mean, you know, I didn't really, it was embarrassing. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I wasn't completely overwhelmed because I was innocent, for one. You know what I'm saying? You feel me?
Gotcha.
But I was always, you know, I was humbled and appreciative for such a grounding experience. You know what I mean? Like,
gotcha.
And I just felt renewed in my faith and feeling like, okay, I have deliberately and intentionally done the good I have done, you know what I mean, to guarantee in some regard, you know what I mean, a victory, a greater victory in my personal life and professional life, and be a means of motivation and inspiration in other people of whom are my passion and whom I care about. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? More so than myself. You know what I'm saying? I, you know, which that's why I said I was all willing to die a revolutionary, because I would have given my life. I didn't value my own life in that way. I value, you know, saying the legacy of a people. You know what I mean? Like, you feel me? Disenfranchised. I mean, like, you know, and I just felt like those things that were put on my heart and on my spirit to speak on, you know, and the fact, just the mere fact that I was being affected and people were listening and people were being changed because of it. You know, I felt like, you know, when my mother and fathers, the associate pastors, would say to me as a child, "You're going to be a minister." You know, I felt like prophecy was coming to pass because of music. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So I felt still like good. I was doing. I felt like I was doing what I was always meant to do. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I just wanted, you know, I wish it was just some kind of way that I could remind people or refer them back to what I had done. I'm like, man, please, y'all, don't forget about what I did. I did this, you know, like, for no money. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? Mm-hmm. No money in what we was doing as good and mine. We were writing songs about martial law in 1995. What are they doing that?
I want to talk to you about Atlanta. Like, we got to talk about Atlanta.
What are they doing? Oh, shit, you are in Atlanta.
Yes.
I wasn't trying to say nothing. You know what I'm saying? Like, we weren't doing nothing but trying to share. You know what I'm saying? Like, and be our highest selves. You know what I mean? With that opportunity, because we all had a deep sense of appreciation. And you know, hey man, I was married to a black woman, got a black son. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, my mother was one of the first several black fire women in Atlanta, Georgia. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? Like, I got some wonderful, some gigantic women around me who I come from. You know what I mean? Like, and I would never do such a thing. You know what I'm saying?
How did you approach that conversation with your son? Because I get, well, he's 19 now, but I mean, he was, you know, a little younger at the time. How do y'all have that conversation in terms of what,
it was hard then when they were younger, man, because they become victimized. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, and the guilt by association, just the embarrassment, man. Like, you know, I can't even really put that into words. It just took time. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know what I mean? Like, time and tangibility of just me being there, me being able to touch and feel. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, and you know, a lot of people would say that, you know, hey man, my kids know me, but you gotta be transparent.
They don't.
With
not
kids.
Until you talk they don't, to them. You know what I'm saying? They really don't. Talk. And yeah, they've been watching you. The thing I've learned just in fatherhood, like, they've been watching the things that you don't think they see, or like you've been telling them one thing or whatever, but they've been watching everything else, and they've been picking up on stuff that you might not even think that they was looking at. And it's like, damn, you
absolutely
repeat that. And, you know what I'm saying?
No, man. But my son, y'all watch for him too, man. Like, he's been producing me, you know what I'm saying? Like, as of late, and he is, you know, we did, on my IG, you can check it out. We did like some Callaway Family Band posts, you know, like, he taught my fiance Shani how to play bass and guitar.
Wow.
And, you know, we were doing that a lot throughout the quarantine. So no, he's accomplished and he's dope. I mean, like, so like, he's like me when I was a kid. Like, I liked Judas Priest and Motley Crue and Black Sabbath when I was a kid. So he likes System of a Down and Slipknot and stuff like that.
What's
so,
his producer name, Sila?
His producer name is Poinsettia.
What?
Okay. His IG is Poinsettia Garden. He doesn't really post a lot, but you know, like, he's a quiet kid and he's reserved, but like, he's really talented. So
is he with you like full time, or is he with his mom? Like, how do y'all work that out?
You know, any place I got, he got. You know what I'm saying? So like, 100%. I would never get a one bedroom somewhere. Like, it's like, I'm make sure I got two, so he got somewhere to
imagine
be.
That.
You know what I'm saying?
I know how that goes.
Hey, so, well, anything can happen in hours. That's the times that we live in right now. Anything could happen. What do you feel like right now, seeing what's happening in Atlanta, Georgia?
Man, it's kind of like what we was talking about, you know, earlier, man, just like with the music and the way that, you know, activism had always been, you know, our unified front. You know what I mean? I feel saddened and I feel disappointed and I feel angered and I feel, but I feel impassioned. And I do feel like, you know, we're worked against, you know what I mean? Like, when I say we, I mean in terms of like conscious music, You know what I mean? Like, there's really no outlet. There's no platform. You know what I mean? Like, you know, for it, it's like, but that's where we're supposed to be thriving. You know what I mean? Like, there hasn't been a movement, you know, of an era, of a generation where the music didn't reflect the sign of the times. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I believe that there's just a large disconnect. You know what I mean? It's like, but how can we make not only those protest songs, but like those historical timeless songs, you know what I mean? Like that last, you know, that last, you know, in going forward. I mean, like, because I do see that people addressing the issues with sound bites and montages of the current events and things of that nature. You know what I mean? But like, sometimes it's a little disheartening to me because, like, you know, I hate for any of us as artists to have to be, you know, conveniently Black or, you know what I mean? Like, you know, what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. you know, in any kind of way, man. Like, I really would like for that to be, you know, our disposition, you know what I mean? Like, in our narrative, you know, going forward. You know what I mean? Like, you know, we've got to create counterbalances, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like for our culture, or else we will be defined, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, like, you know, as it stands, you know what I mean? And so I have my opinions, but, you know, like, it's sometimes it's, you know, I hate to cop out by saying, like, it's ultimately what the people want. You know what I mean? Like, you know, give people what they want. You know what I mean? It's just like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, because like, I think people are looking here, since you talk about, you know, you have a 19-year-old son and you a Black man and you in Atlanta, and we just saw what happened with Raynard, and that's, you thought that George Floyd, right, was going to be the, you know,
right?
Do y'all know that I was coming home from a meeting and, you know, I just saw that the traffic was gridlocked, and I know Atlanta traffic. I'm like, this ain't moving. But I didn't realize what had happened until I got home, because I was coming through the city and I still had like another 45 minutes to travel to get home. And then I realized the incident, you know, and the tragedy that had just taken place, and they were rioting right there. So, like, you know what I mean? Like,
down 75.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, university, yeah, man, like, you know, that's damn near, you know, that's home for me. You know what I mean? Like, I'm from here. You know what I mean? So, like, you're seeing it firsthand. You know, we've had, you know, even going back, you know, a few weeks to COVID in March, you know, since Shawnee, my fiance's, you know, her father and her uncle passed within days apart, you know what I mean, due to unrelated health issues. But we took, I mean, like, we've taken real losses. You know what I'm saying? And we continue to take losses.
In a small amount of time right now.
Yeah, I'm just like, damn. You know what I mean? So, like, we can't go back to perpetuating and celebrating our stereotypes and our, and reveling in our ignorance and our, you know, inaccountability. You know what I mean? You feel me? Like, we've got to be responsible. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Like, about the things we say and the images we portray and going forward. I mean, like, and, you know, I don't know. We need, but, like, you know, that kind of music, that kind of content, you know what I mean? Like, that's independent action. I mean, like, it's most certainly not affirmative action. So we have to support, you know, that balance, you know what I mean? Like, you know, and sustain that balance for ourselves, because, I mean, literally our lives are depending on it. You know what I mean? Because music is, you know, it is, in my opinion, me being an artist, I consider it to be essential work. You know what I mean? Like, I believe mm-hmm. that we
absolutely
should be considered as essential workers.
DJs, you know, have been getting people through this shit. Yes. Like, yeah, all that, like, for real.
Thank you, Twitch.
You know?
Well, thank you. Brother CeeLo, thank you very much for your time. This is an epic interview.
All of your time, the years.
3 hours. We appreciate this.
Nah, this is amazing, so man. And just as from MC to MC, and just, you know, you were just a huge inspiration and still are, you know, a huge inspiration for me. Just the transition to using your singing voice and just hearing you talk about it. Like, it's so many parallels to my career. And I just thank you just for the inspiration and for the work, brother, for real.
Fine. You've quoted me so many times in this interview, man. I really can't believe it, man. I had no idea that you cut that, as we say, you cut that hard for me, man. I really appreciate the love.
Absolutely. Lay,
it was a pleasure to meet you. You look just like a good friend of mine named Kim, Sugar Steve, you know, and of course, the almighty Questlove, you know what I mean?
Thank you,
y'all, for having me, you know.
Thank you,
I got number love for y'all. So I hope, you know, that the content that we got here is of some use. It's not just a bunch of crap.
This is fucking amazing.
Nah, dog, this is atypical episode. We thank you.
But not so all much because right. it's you. And I hope that you enjoyed your experience too. I hope you
will. I did. Okay. I thank y'all for having me, man. I didn't have no idea. I just knew I was talking to Quest today.
They don't be telling nobody nothing. I love it.
I know. So I will say, CeeLo, thank you very much for doing our show. This has been long overdue.
Man, this is amazing.
I hope you enjoyed this. Yes. So on behalf of Laia, Sugar Steve, you cool, Sugar Steve?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Exactly. Bill's over there. Just
I'm doing better than
pretty
Bill.
Ken. Pretty Ken over there.
Pretty great. Fat Keith. Fat Keith. Right?
Yo, y'all. We will see you on the next go round of Questlove Supreme. We appreciate you. Stay safe. All right. See y'all later.
Peace.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.